solved, and Vic fired up another. The hills and trails led them deeper into Hammer Valley, and finally to the crumbling home of one Jesse McKeever. "Who is Mr. McKeever, and why are we visiting him?" she asked from the rear seat as they turned into the driveway. "A potential client," Donovan said. "He's lost his wife, one son, one daughter, one brother, and two cousins to cancer. Kidney, liver, lung, brain. Pretty much entire body." The truck stopped, and they waited a second for the dog. An angry pit bull flew off the porch and raced at them, ready to eat the tires. Vic honked, and Jesse finally emerged. He called the dog, struck him with his cane, cursed him, and ordered him into the backyard. The stricken dog obeyed and disappeared. They sat on crates and battered lawn chairs under a tree in the front yard. Samantha was not introduced to Jesse, who completely ignored her. He was a rugged old cuss who looked much older than 60, with few teeth and thick wrinkles made permanent by a hard life and a harsh scowl that never left his face. Vic had tested the water from the McKeever well, and the results, while predictable, were grim. The water was polluted with VOCs, volatile organic compounds, poisons such as vinyl chloride, trichloroethylene, mercury, lead, and a dozen others. With great patience, Vic explained what the big words meant. Jesse got the gist of the message. Not only was it unsafe to drink, it should not be used for anything, period. Not for cooking, bathing, brushing teeth, washing clothes, or dishes. Nothing. Jesse explained that they had started hauling in their drinking water some 15 years earlier, but had continued to use well water for bathing and household cleaning. His boy died first, cancer in his digestive tract. Donovan turned on a tape recorder and placed it on a rubber milk crate. Casually and with complete empathy, he elicited an hour's worth of background on Jesse's family and the cancers that had ravaged it. Vic listened and smoked and occasionally asked a question himself. The stories were gut-wrenching, but Jesse went through them with little emotion. He had seen so much misery, and he had been hardened by it. "I want you to join our lawsuit, Mr. McKeever," Donovan said after he turned off the recorder. "We're planning to sue Kroll Mining in federal court. We think we can prove that they dumped a lot of waste in their pond up there, and that they've known for years that it was leaking into the groundwater down here." Jesse rested his chin on his cane and seemed to doze. "No lawsuit will bring them back. They're gone forever." "True, but they didn't have to die. That slurry pond killed them, and the men who own it should have to pay." "How much?" "I can't promise you a dime, but we'll sue Kroll for millions. You'll have plenty of company, Mr. McKeever. As of now, I have about 30 other families here in Hammer Valley, signed up and ready to go. All lost someone to cancer, all within the past 10 years. Jesse spat to his side, wiped his mouth on a sleeve, and said, "I heard about you. Plenty of talk up and down the valley. Some folks want to sue. Others are still scared of the coal company, even though it's finished up there. I don't know what to do, really. I'll just tell you that. Don't know which way to go." "Okay. Think about it. But promise me one thing. When you get ready to fight, call me, not some other lawyer. I've been working on this case for 3 years, and we haven't even filed suit yet. I need you on my side, Mr. McKeever." He agreed to think it over, and Donovan promised to come back in a couple weeks. They left Jesse in the shade, the dog once again by his side, and drove away. Nothing was said until Samantha asked, "Okay, how do you prove the company knew its sludge pond was contaminating Mr. McKeever's water?" The two in the front seat exchanged a look, and for a few seconds there was no response. Vic reached for a cigarette, and Donovan finally said, "The company has internal documents that clearly prove it knew of the contamination and did nothing. In fact, it has covered up everything for the past 10 years. She opened her window again, took a long breath, and asked, "How did you get the documents if you haven't filed suit yet?"
"I didn't say we have the documents," Donovan said a bit defensively.
Vic added, "There have been a few investigations by the EPA and other regulatory agencies. There's a lot of paperwork."
"Did the EPA find these bad documents?" she asked. Both men seemed tentative.
"Not all of them," Vic replied. There was a gap in the conversation as she backed off. They turned onto a gravel road and bounced along for a mile or so.
"When will you file the lawsuit?" she asked.
"Soon," Donovan said.
"Well, if I'm going to work in your office, I need to know these things, right?"
Donovan did not respond. They turned into the front yard of an old trailer and parked behind a dirty car with no hubcaps and a bumper hanging by a wire.
"And who is this?" she asked.
"Dolly Swaney," Donovan said. "Her husband died of liver cancer 2 years ago, at the age of 41.
"Is she a client?"
"Not yet," Donovan said as he opened the door.
Dolly Swaney appeared on the front porch, a crumbling addition with broken steps. She was huge and wore a large, stained gown that fell almost to her bare feet.
"I think I'll wait in the truck," Samantha said. They had an early lunch at the only diner in downtown Rockville, a hot, stuffy cafe with the smell of grease heavy in the air. The waitress placed 3 glasses of ice water on the table. All 3 glasses went untouched. Instead, they ordered diet sodas to go with their sandwiches. With no one sitting close, Samantha decided to continue the questioning.
"So, if you already have 30 clients, and you've been working on the case for 3 years, why haven't you filed suit by now?"
Both men glanced around as if someone might be listening. Satisfied, Donovan answered in a low voice.
"This is a huge case, Samantha. Dozens of deaths, a defendant with enormously deep pockets, and liability that I think we can make clear at trial. I've already spent $100,000 on the case, and it'll take much more than that to get it before a jury. It takes time. Time to sign up the clients, time to do the research, time to put together a legal team that can fight the army of lawyers and experts Kroll Mining will throw at its defense.
It's also dangerous," Vic added. "There are a lot of bad actors in these coal fields, and Kroll Mining is one of the worst. Not only is it a ruthless strip miner, it's also a vicious litigator. It's a beautiful lawsuit, but dealing with Kroll Mining has scared away a lot of lawyers, guys who are usually on board in the big environmental cases."
Donovan said, "That's why I need some help. If you're bored and looking for some excitement, then let's go to work. I have a ton of documents that need to be reviewed." She suppressed a laugh and said, "Great, more document review. I spent the first year with the firm buried in a vault doing nothing but document review. In big law, it's the curse of every rookie associate. This will be different, I assure you."
"Are these the incriminating documents?
The good stuff?"
Both men glanced around again. The waitress arrived with the diet sodas and left them. It was doubtful she cared anything about litigation. Samantha leaned in low and hit them hard with,
"You already have these documents, don't you?"
Donovan replied,
"Let's just say we have access to them. They went missing. Kroll Mining knows they're missing, but they don't know who has them. After I file the lawsuit, the company will learn that I have access to them. That's all I can say. As he spoke, Vic stared at her intently, watching for her reaction. His look said, "Can she be trusted?" His look was also skeptical. He wanted to talk about something else. She asked, "What will Kroll Mining do when it knows you have access?" "Go berserk. But what the hell? We'll be in federal court, hopefully with a good judge, one who will hold their feet to the fire." Their platters arrived, scrawny sandwiches beside piles of fries, and they began eating. Vic asked her about New York and her life there. They were intrigued by her work in a firm with 1,000 lawyers in the same building, and by her specialty in building skyscrapers. She was tempted to make it sound slightly glamorous, but couldn't muster the necessary deceit. As she ignored the sandwich and played with the fries, she couldn't help but wonder where Blythe and her friends were lunching. No doubt some chic restaurant in the village, with cloth napkins, a wine list, and designer cuisine. Another world. Chapter 14. The Skyhawk climbed to 5,000 feet, leveled off, and Donovan asked, "Are you ready?" By then, she was enjoying flying at lower altitudes and absorbing the views. But she had no desire to take the controls. "Gently grab the yoke," he said. And she did. "I've got it too, so don't worry," he said calmly. The yoke controls the pitch of the nose, up and down, and it also turns the airplane. All movements are small and slow. "Turn it slightly to the right." She did, and they began a gradual bank to her side. She turned back to the left, and they leveled off. She pushed the yoke forward, the nose dipped, and they began losing altitude. She glanced at the altimeter. "Level off at 4,500, he said. "Keep the wings level." From 4,500 feet, they ascended back to 5,000. And Donovan put his hands in his lap. "How does it feel?" "Awesome," she said. "I can't believe I'm doing this. It's so easy." The Skyhawk responded to the slightest movement of the yoke. Once she realized she was not going to crash it, she managed to relax a little and enjoy the thrill of her first flight. "It's a great airplane. Simple and safe. And you're flying it. You could go solo in a month." "Let's not rush things." They flew straight and level for a few minutes, without talking. Samantha watched the instruments closely, glancing only briefly at the mountains below. He asked, "So, Captain, where are we going?" "I have no idea. Not sure where we are, and not sure where we're going." "What would you like to see?" She thought for a moment. "Maddie told me about your family's place and what happened there. I'd like to see Gray Mountain." He hesitated for a second and said, "Then look at the heading indicator and turn left to a heading of 190 degrees. Do it slow and stay level." She executed the turn perfectly and kept the Skyhawk at 5,000 feet. After a few minutes, she asked, "Okay, what would happen right now if the engine quit?" He sort of shrugged, as if this never crossed his mind. "First, I would try and restart it. If that didn't work, I'd start looking for a flat surface, a pasture or a pipeline, maybe even a highway. At 5,000 feet, a Skyhawk will glide for about 7 miles, so there's a lot of time. When I found my spot, I would circle around it, try and gauge the wind on the descent, and pull off a perfect emergency landing." I don't see any open areas down there.
Then just pick your mountain and hope for the best.
Sorry I asked.
Relax. Fatalities in these planes are rare, and they're always caused by pilot error. He yawned and went quiet for a while. Samantha found it impossible to relax entirely, but was growing more confident by the minute. After a long break in conversation, she glanced at her co-pilot, who appeared to be dozing. Was he joking with her, or was he really asleep? Her first impulse was to yell into her mic and startle him. Instead, she checked the instruments, made sure the airplane was flying straight and the wings were perfectly level, and fought the urge to panic. She caught herself gripping the yoke and let go for a second. The fuel gauge showed half a tank. If he wanted to sleep, go ahead. She would give him a few minutes to nap, then panic. She released the yoke again and realized the plane would fly by itself, with only a light touch here and there for corrections. She glanced at her watch. 5 minutes, 10, 15. The mountains were slowly passing under them. There was nothing on the radar to indicate traffic. She kept her cool, but there was a growing sense that she needed to scream. He awoke with a cough and quickly scanned the instruments.
Nice job, Samantha.
How was your nap?
Fine. Sometimes I get sleepy up here. The drone of the engine gets monotonous, and I have trouble staying awake. On long trips, I'll turn on the autopilot and doze off for a few minutes. She wasn't sure how to respond to this, and let it pass.
Do you know where we are? She asked. He looked ahead and without hesitation said,
Sure, we're approaching Nolan County. At 11 o'clock is Cat Mountain.
You'll fly just to the left of it, and I'll take over from there.
Descend to 4,000 feet.
They flew over the edge of Brady at 3,000 feet, and Donovan took the controls.
You want to fly it again sometime? He asked.
Maybe. I don't know. How long does it take to learn everything?
About 30 hours of ground school, or self-study, and another 30 in the air. The problem is there's no instructor around here. Had one, but he died. In a plane crash.
I think I'll just stick to cars.
I grew up in a world of plane crashes, so I've always been wary of aviation. I'll let you do the flying.
Anytime, he said, smiling. He kept the nose pitched downward until they were 1,000 feet above the terrain. They flew beside a strip mine where blasting was underway. A thick cloud of black smoke hung close to the ground. On the horizon, steeples were peeking above the trees.
Have you been to Knox? He asked.
No, not yet.
It's the seat of Curry County, where I was born. Nice town, about the same size and sophistication as Brady, so you haven't missed much.
They flew over the town, but there wasn't much to see, at least not from 1,000 feet. They began climbing again, weaving around the taller peaks until they were deep in the mountains. They topped one, and Donovan said,
There it is. What's left of Gray Mountain?
The company abandoned it 20 years ago, but by the time they left, most of the coal was gone. Lawsuits tied up everything for years. Obviously, the site did not get reclaimed. Probably the ugliest spot in all of Appalachia. It was a desolate landscape, with open gashes where coal was being extracted when the crews suddenly stopped, and mounds of overfill left to sit forever. And all over the site, scrawny trees trying desperately to survive. Most of the mine was rock and soil, but patches of brown grass had grown up. The valley fill dropping from the site was partially covered with vines and shrubbery. As Donovan began to circle, he said,
The only thing worse than a reclaimed strip mine is one that's been abandoned. That's what happened here. Still makes me sick.
Who owns it now?
My father. It's still in the family, but it's not worth much. The land is ruined. The streams disappeared under the valley fill. All the fish are gone. The water is poison.
The wildlife ran off to a safer place.
Did Maddie tell you what happened to my mother?
She did, but not in detail.
He descended and banked steeply to the right so she looked straight down.
Do you see that white cross down there, with rocks around it?
Yes, I see it.
That's where she died.
Our home was over there, an old family place built by my grandfather, who was a deep miner. After the flood destroyed the home, my mother found a spot there, near the rocks, and that's where it happened. My brother Jeff and I found some old timbers from the house and built that cross.
Who found her?
He took a deep breath and said, "So, Maddie didn't tell you everything."
"I guess not."
"I found her." Nothing was said for a few minutes as Donovan buzzed the valley on the east side of Gray Mountain. There were no roads, homes, or signs of people. He banked again and said, "Just over this ridge here is the only part of the property that wasn't ruined. The water flows in another direction, and the valley was safe from the strip mine. You see that creek down there?" He banked steeper so she could.
"Yes, I got it.
Yellow Creek. I have a little cabin on that creek, a hiding place few people know about. I'll show it to you sometime."
I'm not so sure about that, Samantha thought. We are now close enough, and pending some change in your marital status, I have no plans to get closer.
But she nodded and said, "I'd like to see it." "There's the chimney," he said. "It's barely visible, both from here and on the ground. No plumbing, no electricity. You sleep in hammocks. I built it myself with help from my brother Jeff."
"Where's your father?"
"Last I heard, he was in Montana, but I haven't spoken to him in many years."
"Have you seen enough?"
"I believe so."
At the Nolan County Airfield, Donovan taxied close to the terminal, but did not kill the engine. Instead, he said,
"Okay, I want you to get out here, carefully, and walk behind the airplane. The prop is still spinning."
"You're not getting out?"
she asked, pulling the latch on her shoulder harness.
"No, I'm going to Roanoke to see my wife and daughter. Be back tomorrow, and at the office."
Samantha got out under the wing, felt the rush of air from the propeller, walked behind the tail, and waited at the door. She waved at Donovan, who gave her the thumbs up, and began taxiing away. She watched him take off and drove back to Brady. Saturday dinner was a pot of Chester's legendary Texas chili. He'd never been to Texas, as best he could remember, but found a great recipe only 2 years ago on a website. The legend part seemed more or less a creation of his own imagination, but his enthusiasm for cooking and entertaining was infectious. Maddie baked cornbread, and Annette brought a chocolate pie for dessert. Samantha had never learned to cook, and was now living in a tiny apartment with only a hot plate and a toaster, so she got a pass. While Chester stirred the pot and added spices and talked nonstop, Kim and Adam made a pizza in Aunt Maddie's kitchen. Saturday was always pizza night for them, and Samantha was delighted to be at the Wyatts and not stuck again with Annette and the kids. In their eyes, she was no longer a roommate slash babysitter, but in 1 week had risen to the hallowed status of big sister. They loved her, and she loved them, but the walls were closing in.
Annette seemed content to allow the kids to smother her. They ate in the backyard, at a picnic table under a maple tree, ablaze with bright yellow leaves. The ground was covered with them too, a beautiful carpet that would soon be gone. Candles were lit as the sun disappeared behind the mountains. Claudel, their paralegal, joined them late. Maddie had a rule that over dinner there would be no shop talk, nothing about the clinic, their work, their clients, and especially nothing even remotely related to coal. So they dwelt on politics, Obama versus McCain, Biden versus Palin. Politics naturally led to discussions about the economic disaster unfolding around the world. All news was bad, and while the experts disagreed on whether it would be a minor depression or just a deep recession, it still seemed far away, like another genocide in Africa. Awful, but not really touching Brady yet. They were curious about Samantha's friends in New York. For the third or fourth time that afternoon and evening, Samantha noticed a detached coolness in Annette's words and attitude toward her. She seemed fine when talking to everyone else, but slightly abrupt when she said anything to Samantha. At first, she thought nothing of it. But by the time dinner was over, she was certain something was gnawing at Annette. It was puzzling, because nothing had happened between them. Finally, she suspected it had something to do with Donovan. Chapter 15. Samantha awoke to the pleasant sounds of distant church bells. There seemed to be several melodies in the air, some closer or louder, others farther away, but all busy rousing the town folk with not so gentle reminders that the Sabbath had arrived and the doors were open. It was 9:02, according to her digital clock, and she once again marveled at her ability to sleep. She thought about rolling over and going for more, but after 10 hours, enough was enough. The coffee was ready, the aroma drifting from the other room. She poured a cup and sat on the sofa and thought about her day. With little to do, her first goal was to avoid Annette and the kids. She called her mother and gabbed for 30 minutes about this and that. Karen, typically, was absorbed in the latest crisis at Justice and rattled on about it. Her boss was having urgent preliminary meetings to organize plans to investigate big banks and purveyors of subprime mortgages and all manner of Wall Street crooks. And this would begin as soon as the dust settled, and they figured out exactly who was responsible for the mess. Such talk bored Samantha, but she gamely held on, sipping coffee in her pajamas and listening to the nonstop church bells. Karen mentioned driving down to Brady in the near future for her first real look at life in the mountains, but Samantha knew it was all talk. Her mother rarely left D.C. Her work was too important. She finally asked about the internship and the legal clinic. "How long will you stay?" she asked. Samantha said she had no plans to leave anytime soon. When the bell stopped, she put on jeans and left her apartment. Annette's car was still parked in front of the house, an indication that she and the kids were skipping church on this beautiful Sunday. From a rack near Donovan's office on Main Street, Samantha bought a copy of the Roanoke Times and read it in an empty cafe while she ate a waffle with bacon. After breakfast, she walked the streets of Brady for a while. It didn't take long to see all of it. She passed a dozen churches, which all seemed to be packed, judging by the crowded parking lots, and tried to remember the last time she had seen the inside of one. Her father was a lapsed Catholic, her mother an indifferent Protestant, and Samantha had not been raised in any faith. She found the schools, all as old as the courthouse, all with rusting air conditioners sagging from the windows. She said hello to a porch full of ancient people rocking their time away at the nursing home, evidently too old even for church. She walked past the tiny hospital and vowed to never get sick in Brady. She walked along Main Street and wondered how in the world the small merchant stayed in business. When the tour was over, she got in her car and left. On the map, Highway 119 wiggled through the coal country of far eastern Kentucky and into West Virginia. The day before, she had seen Appalachia from the air. Now, she would try it from the road. With Charleston a vague destination, she took off with nothing but a road map and a bottle of water. Soon she was in Kentucky, though the state line made little difference. Appalachia was Appalachia, regardless of boundaries someone had set an eternity ago. A land of breathtaking beauty, of steep hills and rolling mountains covered in dense hardwood forests, of rushing streams and rapids cutting through deep valleys, of depressing poverty, of tidy little towns with red brick buildings and whitewashed houses, of church after church. Most of them seemed to be of the Baptist variety, though the brands were hopelessly confusing. Southern Baptist, General Baptist, Primitive Baptist, Missionary Baptist. Regardless, they were all bustling with activity. She stopped in Pikeville, Kentucky, population 7,000, found the center of town, and treated herself to coffee amongst the locals in a stuffy cafe. She got some looks, but everyone was friendly. She listened hard to the chatter, at times uncertain if it was the same language, and even chuckled at the banter. Near the West Virginia line, she couldn't resist stopping at a country store that advertised, "World-famous beef jerky, homemade." She bought a package, took one bite, tossed the rest in a trash can, and sipped water for 15 miles to get rid of the taste. She was determined not to think about coal. She was tired of the subject, but it was everywhere, in the haul trucks that owned the roads, in the fading billboards urging union strength, in the occasional glimpse of a strip mine and a mountaintop being removed, in the battle of bumper stickers with "Like electricity, love coal" on one side and "Save the mountains" on the other, and in the tiny museums honoring the heritage of mining. She stopped at a historical marker and read the account of the Bark Valley disaster, a deep mine explosion that killed 30 men in 1961. Friends of Coal had an aggressive campaign underway, and she drove past many of their billboards declaring, "Coal equals jobs." Coal was the fabric of life in these parts, but the strip mining had divided the people. According to her internet research, its opponents argued that it destroyed jobs, and they had the numbers to support them. 80,000 miners now, almost all non-union, and half working in surface mines. Decades earlier, long before they began blasting tops off mountains, there were almost 1 million miners. She eventually made it to Charleston, the capital. She still wasn't comfortable in traffic and found more than she expected. She had no idea where she was going and was suddenly afraid of getting lost. It was almost 2 p.m., past lunch, and time to turn around. The first leg of her trip ended when she randomly pulled into a strip mall surrounded by fast food restaurants. She was craving a burger and fries. All the lights were on in Donovan's office long after sunset. She walked by it once around 8, started to knock, but decided not to disturb him. At 9, she was at her desk, primarily because she wanted to avoid her apartment and not really working. She called his cell and he answered it. "Are you busy?" she asked. "Of course I'm busy. I start a trial tomorrow. What are you doing?" "I'm at the office, puttering, bored." "Come on over. I want you to meet someone." They were in his war room upstairs, the tables covered with open books and files and legal pads. Donovan introduced her to one Lenny Charlton, a jury consultant from Knoxville. He described the man as an overpaid but frequently effective analyst, and he described Samantha simply as a lawyer friend who was on his side. Samantha wondered if Donovan insulted all the experts he hired. He asked Lenny, "Ever hear of Marshall Kofer out of D.C., once a high-flying aviation trial lawyer?" "Of course," Lenny said. "Her dad. But there's nothing in the DNA. She avoids courtrooms. Smart lady." They were ending a long session in which they had gone through the list of 60 prospective jurors. Lenny explained, for her benefit, that his firm was paid trifling wages to conduct background searches of every person on the list, and that the chore was difficult, given the tight and incestuous nature of coalfield communities. "Excuses, excuses," Donovan mumbled, almost under his breath. Lenny explained further that picking juries in coal country was dicey because everyone had a friend or a relative who worked either for a company that mined coal or for one that provided services to the industry. Samantha listened with fascination as they discussed the last few names on the list. One woman's brother worked at a strip mine. One woman's father had been a deep miner. One man lost his adult son in a construction accident, but it wasn't related to coal. And so on. There seemed to be something wrong with this spying game of allowing litigants to peek into the private lives of unsuspecting people. She would ask Donovan about it later if she had the chance. He looked tired and seemed a bit edgy. Lenny left a few minutes before 10. When they were alone, she asked, "Why don't you have co-counsel for this trial?" "I often do, but not this case. I prefer to do it myself. Strayhorn and its insurance company will have a dozen dark suits swarming around their table. I like the contrast. Just Lisa Tate and me. David and Goliath, huh?" "Something like that." "How late will you work?" "I don't know. I won't sleep much tonight. Or this week, for that matter. Comes with the territory. Look, I know it's late and you have better things to worry about, but I have to ask you something. You've offered me a part-time job as a research assistant, a paid position, so I would become an employee of your firm, right?"
"Right. Where is this going?"
"Hang on. I'm not sure I want to work for you." He shrugged.
"Whatever. I'm not begging."
"Here's the question. Do you have in your possession documents, the bad documents, as you and Vic call them, owned by Kroll Mining, pertaining to the contamination of the groundwater in Hammer Valley? Documents that you're not supposed to have?" His dark and tired eyes flashed with anger, but he bit his tongue, hesitated, then smiled. "It's a direct question, counselor," she said.
"I get that.
So, if the answer is yes, then I suppose you'll decline the job and we'll still be friends, right?" "You answer my question first." "And if the answer is no, then you might consider working for me, right?" "I'm still waiting, counselor. I plead the Fifth Amendment." "Fair enough. Thank you for the offer, but I'll say no." "As you wish. I have lots of work to do." Black lung is a legal term for a preventable occupational lung disease. It is more formally known as coal workers' pneumoconiosis, CWP, and is caused by prolonged exposure to coal dust. Once coal dust is inhaled into the body, it cannot be removed or discharged. It progressively builds up in the lungs and can lead to inflammation, fibrosis, even necrosis. There are two forms of the disease, simple CWP and complicated CWP, or progressive massive fibrosis. Black lung is a common affliction among coal miners, both in deep mines and surface mines. It is estimated that 10% of all miners with 25 years' experience develop the disease. It is debilitating and usually fatal. Approximately 1,500 miners die each year from black lung, and because of the insidious nature of the disease, their deaths are almost always slow and agonizing. There is no cure and no effective medical treatment. The symptoms are shortness of breath and a constant cough that often yields a black mucus. As these grow worse, the miner faces the dilemma of whether or not to pursue benefits. Diagnosis is fairly straightforward. 1. An exposure history to coal dust. 2. A chest x-ray. And 3. The exclusion of other causes. In 1969, Congress passed the Federal Coal Mine Health and Safety Act, which established a compensation system for victims of black lung. The law also set up standards to reduce coal dust. 2 years later, Congress created the Black Lung Disability Trust Fund and funded it with a federal tax on coal production. In this law, the coal industry agreed to a system designed to ease the identification of the disease and to guarantee compensation. If a miner had worked 10 years and had medical proof, either an x-ray or autopsy evidence of severe black lung, then in theory, he was to be awarded benefits. Also, a miner still working with black lung was to be transferred to a job with less exposure to dust without the loss of pay, benefits, or seniority. As of July 1st, 2008, a miner with black lung receives $900 a month from the trust. The intent of the new federal law was to sharply reduce exposure to coal dust. Tough standards were soon in place, and miners were offered free chest x-rays every 5 years. The x-rays showed 4 in 10 miners tested had some level of black lung, but in the years after the law took effect, new cases of black lung plunged by 90%. Doctors and experts predicted the disease would be eradicated. However, by 1995, government studies began to indicate an increase in the rate of the disease. Then, an even bigger increase. Just as troublesome, the disease appeared to progress more rapidly, and it was showing up in the lungs of younger miners. Experts share two theories for this. 1, miners are working longer shifts, and thus are exposed to more dust. And 2, coal operators are exposing miners to illegal concentrations of coal dust. Black lung is now epidemic in the coal fields, and the only possible reason is a prolonged exposure to more dust than the law allows. For decades, the coal companies have resisted efforts to strengthen the standards, and they have been successful. The law does not allow a miner to pay a lawyer. Therefore, a typical miner with a claim must try to navigate the federal black lung system by himself. The coal industry is harshly resistant to claims, regardless of the proof offered by the miner. The companies fight the claims with experienced attorneys who skillfully manipulate the system. For a miner who prevails, his process usually takes about 5 years. For Thomas Wilcox, the ordeal lasted 12 years. He was born near Brady, Virginia, in 1925. Fought in the war, was wounded twice, decorated, and upon his return home, he got married and went to work in the mines. He was a proud miner, a staunch union man, a loyal Democrat, and a fine husband and father. In 1974, he was diagnosed with black lung disease and filed a claim. He had been sick for several years and was almost too weak to work. His chest x-ray clearly showed complicated CWP. He had worked underground for 28 years and had never smoked. His claim was initially approved, but the award was appealed by the coal company. In 1976, at the age of 51, Thomas had no choice but to retire. he continued to deteriorate, and he was soon on oxygen around the clock. With no income, his family scrambled to support themselves and cover his medical expenses. He and his wife were forced to sell the family home and live with an older daughter. His black lung claim was thoroughly choked up deep within the federal system by crafty attorneys working for the coal company. At the time, he was due about $300 a month, plus medical care. By the end, Thomas was a shriveled skeleton, stuck in a wheelchair, and gasping for breath as the final days passed and his family prayed for a merciful end. He could not speak and was fed baby food by his wife and daughters. Through the generosity of friends and neighbors and the tireless efforts of his family, the supply of oxygen was never depleted. He weighed 104 pounds when he died in 1986 at the age of 61. An autopsy yielded incontrovertible proof of black lung. 4 months later, the coal company dropped its appeal. 12 years after he filed his claim, his widow received a lump sum settlement for back benefits. Note: Thomas Wilcox was my father. He was a proud war hero, though he never talked about his battles. He was a son of the mountains and loved their beauty, history, and way of life. He taught us all how to fish the clear streams, camp in the caves, and even hunt deer for food. He was an active man who slept little and preferred to read late into the night. We watched him gradually slow down as the disease took its grip. Every miner fears black lung, but he never thinks it will happen to him. As reality set in, Thomas lost his energy and began to brood. The simple tasks around the farm became more difficult. When he was forced to quit the mines, he went into a prolonged period of deep depression. As his body grew weaker and smaller, talking became too strenuous. He needed all of his energy just for breathing. In his final days, we took turns sitting with him and reading his favorite books. Often, he had tears in his eyes. Maddie Wyatt, July 1st, 2008. It was in the last section of the thick binder of seminar materials and had obviously been added later. Samantha had not noticed it before. She put away the binder, found her running shoes, and went for a long walk around Brady. It was after 11 on Sunday night, and she did not see another person outdoors. Chapter 16. Maddie was in court in Curry County. Annette was running late. Part-time Barb had yet to show, and part-time Claudel didn't arrive until noon on Mondays. So Samantha was all alone when Pamela Booker made a noisy entrance with two dirty kids behind her. She was crying by the time she gave her name and started begging for help. Samantha herded them into a conference room and spent the first 5 minutes trying to assure Pamela things would be okay, though she had no idea what things were in play. The kids were mute, with wide eyes and the startled looks of those traumatized. And they were hungry, Pamela said when she settled down. Do you have anything to eat? Samantha raced to the kitchen, found some stale cookies, a pack of saltines, a bag of chips, and two diet sodas from Barb's stash, and placed it all on the table in front of the two children, who grabbed the cookies and bit off huge chunks. Through more tears, Pamela said thanks and began talking. The narrative spilled out so fast, Samantha had no time to take notes. She watched the kids devour the food while their mother told their story. They were living in a car. They were from a small town just over the line in Hopper County. And since they lost their home a month earlier, Pamela had been looking for a lawyer to rescue them. No one would help. but one eventually mentioned the Mountain Legal Aid Clinic over in Brady. Here they were. She had a job in a factory making lamps for a motel chain. It wasn't a great job, but one that paid the rent and bought groceries. There was no husband in the picture. 4 months ago, a company she'd never heard of began garnishing her paycheck, took a third of it, and she couldn't stop it. She complained to her boss, but he just waved a court order at her. Then he threatened to fire her, said he hated garnishment orders because of the hassle. When she argued with him, he followed through with his threat, and she was now unemployed. She went to see the judge and explained everything, told him she couldn't pay her rent and buy food at the same time, but he was not sympathetic, said the law was the law. The problem was an old credit card judgment she hadn't thought about in 10 years. Evidently, the credit card company sold her judgment to some bottom-feeding collection agency, and without her knowledge, an order of garnishment was issued. When she couldn't pay the rent on her trailer, her landlord, a real asshole, called the sheriff and kicked her out. She piled in with a cousin for a few days, but that blew up, and she left to live with a friend. That didn't work either. And for the past 2 weeks, she and the kids had been living in their car, which was low on everything. Oil, air, gas, and brake fluid. The dashboard lit up like a Christmas tree. Yesterday, she shoplifted some chocolate bars and gave them to the kids. She herself had not eaten in 2 days. Samantha absorbed it all and managed to hide her shock. How exactly do you live in a car? She began taking notes without the slightest idea of what to do on the legal front. Pamela pulled out paperwork from her fake designer bag and slid the pile across the table. Samantha scanned a court order while her new client explained she was down to her last $2, and she didn't know whether to spend them on gas or food. She finally took a cookie and held it with shaking hands. Two things dawned on Samantha. The first was that she was the last line of defense for this little family. The second was that they were not leaving anytime soon. There was nowhere to go. When Barb finally arrived, Samantha gave her $20 and asked her to hurry and buy as many sausage biscuits as possible. Barb said, "We keep a few bucks around the office." Samantha replied, "We'll need it." Phoebe Fanning was still hiding from her husband in a motel, courtesy of the clinic, and Samantha was aware that Maddie kept a few bucks on reserve for emergencies like this. After Barb left, Samantha looked through a back window at the parking lot. Pamela's car, even filled with gas and all other necessary fluids, looked as though it wouldn't make it back to Hopper County. It was a small import with 1,000,000 miles on it, and now it was being used as a home. The cookies and saltines were gone when she returned to the conference room. She told Pamela she had sent out for some food, and this made her cry. The boy, Trevor, age 7, said, "Thank you, Miss Kopfer." The girl, Mandy, age 11, asked,
"Could I please use the bathroom?"
"Certainly," Samantha said. She showed her the way down the hall and sat down at the table to take more notes. They started at the beginning and went slowly through the story. The credit card judgment was dated July 1999 and had a balance of $3,398, which included all manner of court costs, obscure fees, even some interest thrown in for good measure. Pamela explained that her ex-husband had been ordered to satisfy the judgment in their divorce decree, a copy of which was in the paperwork. 9 years had passed without a word, at least nothing she was aware of. She had moved several times, and perhaps the mail had not kept up. Who knew? At any rate, the collection agency had found her and started all this trouble. Samantha noted that Trevor, at 7, had been born after the divorce, but this was not worth mentioning. There were several court orders
holding the ex-husband in contempt for failure to pay child support for Mandy.
"Where is he?" she asked.
"I have no idea," Pamela said. "I haven't heard from him in years."
Barb returned with a sack of sausage biscuits and spread the feast on the table. She rubbed Trevor's head and told Mandy how happy she was they had come to visit. All three bookers offered polite thanks, then ate like refugees. Samantha closed the door and huddled with Barb in the reception area.
"What's the deal?" Barb asked.
And Samantha gave her the basics. Barb, who thought she'd seen it all, was puzzled, but never timid.
"I'd start with the boss. Give him a load of hell. Threaten to sue for triple damages. Then go after the collection company."
The phone was ringing, and she reached to answer it, leaving Samantha, the lawyer, alone in her confusion.
A load of hell? Triple damages? For what exactly?
And this advice was from a non-lawyer. Samantha thought about stalling until either Maddie or Annette returned. But she had been there for a week, and orientation was over. She went to her office, closed the door, and nervously punched the number at the lamp factory. A Mr. Simmons was pleasantly surprised to learn that Pamela Booker had herself a lawyer. He said she was a good worker. He hated to lose her and all that. But damned those garnishment orders. It just made his bookkeeping a nightmare. He had already filled her spot, and he'd made sure the new employee had no legal problems.
"Well, you might have some more legal problems," Samantha explained coolly.
Bluffing, and not sure of the law, she explained that a company cannot fire an employee simply because his or her wages are being garnished. This irritated Mr. Simmons, and he mumbled something about his lawyer.
"Great," Samantha said. "Give me her number, and I'll pursue the matter with her."
"Wasn't a woman," he said. "And the guy charged $200 an hour anyway. Give him some time to think about it." Samantha promised to call back that afternoon, and they eventually agreed that 3 p.m. would be convenient. When she returned to the conference room, Barb had found a box of crayons and some coloring books and was busy organizing fun and games for Trevor and Mandy. Pamela was still holding half a sausage biscuit and staring at the floor, as if in a trance. When Annette finally arrived, Samantha met her in the hallway and, whispering, unloaded the details. Annette was still a bit aloof and bothered by something, but business was business.
"The judgment expired years ago," was her first reaction. "Check the law on this. I'll bet the credit card company sold the judgment to the collection company for pennies on the dollar, and now it's enforcing an outdated court order."
"You've seen this before?"
"Something similar, a long time ago. Can't remember the case name.
Do the research, then contact the collection agency. These are generally some nasty characters, and they don't scare easily."
"Can we sue them?"
"We can certainly threaten."
They are not accustomed to people like this suddenly showing up with a lawyer. "Call the boss and burn his ass too."
"I've already done that." Annette actually smiled.
"What did he say?"
"I explained that he cannot fire an employee simply because of a garnishment order. I have no idea if this is accurate, but I made it sound authentic. It worried him, and we're supposed to chat again this afternoon."
"It's not accurate, but it's a nice bluff, which is often more important than whatever the law says.
The lawsuit will be against the collection company, if in fact they are pinching her paychecks from an expired judgment."
"Thanks," Samantha said, taking a deep breath. "But we have more pressing matters. They are in there, and they have no place to go.
I suggest you spend the next few hours taking care of the basics. Food, laundry, a place to sleep. The kids are obviously not in school. Worry about that tomorrow. We have a slush fund to cover some expenses."
"Did you say laundry?"
"I did. Who said legal aid work was all glamour?" The morning's second crisis erupted minutes later
when Phoebe Fanning arrived unannounced with her husband, Randy, and informed Annette she was dropping her divorce. They had reconciled, so to speak, and she and the kids were back home, where things had settled down. Annette was furious and called Samantha into her office to witness the meeting. Randy Fanning had been out of jail for 3 days and was only slightly more presentable, absent the Orange County jumpsuit. He sat with a smirk and kept one hand on Phoebe's arm as she tried her best to explain her change of plans. She loved him, plain and simple, couldn't survive without him, and their 3 children were much happier with their parents together. She was tired of hiding in a motel, and the kids were tired of hiding with relatives, and everyone had made peace. Annette reminded Phoebe that she had been beaten by her husband, who glared across the table as if he might erupt any moment. Annette seemed fearless, while Samantha tried to hide in a corner. It had been a fight, Phoebe explained. Not exactly a fair one, but a fight nonetheless. They had been arguing too much. Things got carried away. It'll never happen again. Randy, who preferred to say nothing, chimed in and confirmed that, yes, they had promised to stop the fighting. Annette listened to him without believing a word. She reminded him that he was violating the terms of the temporary restraining order as he sat there. If the judge found out, he'd go back to jail. He said Hump, his lawyer, had promised to get the order dismissed without a hassle. There were traces of dark bluish color still visible on the side of Phoebe's face from the last fight. Divorce was one matter. The criminal charges were another. Annette got to the serious part when she asked if they had spoken to the prosecutor about dropping the malicious wounding. Not yet, but they planned to do that as soon as the divorce was dismissed. Annette explained that it wouldn't be automatic. The police had a statement from the victim. They had photographs, other witnesses. This seemed a bit confusing, and even Samantha wasn't so sure. If the victim and star witness folds, how do you pursue the case? The 2 lawyers had the same thought. Did he beat her again to coerce her to drop everything? Annette was irritated and hammered away with tough questions, but neither backed down. They were determined to forget their troubles and move on to a happier life. When it was time for the meeting to end, Annette flipped through the file and estimated that she had spent 20 hours on the divorce. At no charge, of course. Next time, find another lawyer. After they left, Annette described them as a couple of meth addicts who were obviously unstable and probably needed each other. Let's just hope he doesn't kill her, she said. As the morning dragged on, it became clear that the Booker family had no plans to leave.